This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. 5 years ago, the Supreme Court considered a case that raised a tough question. How do you deal with threats while protecting free speech? Unprecedented is a podcast from our colleagues at WAMU that explores the stories behind some of the most important free speech cases that have come before the Supreme Court. Today, we'll hear the latest episode of Unprecedented in its entirety. I'll be back later on to discuss the importance of this case 5 years later. Fair warning before we begin, this episode contains threats of graphic domestic violence. Feel free to pause this and listen when you're ready on our website, the1a.org.
I see a lot of cases involving somebody who commits a horrific crime against his wife and or children, and there are lots of warning signs, and these are the warning signs. Language like this is the warning sign. How do you balance the right to free speech in this very typical situation involving domestic, at least terror, if not violence, and try to make sure there isn't a murder?
Not all speech is constitutionally protected. Some speech, the kind that makes someone fear for their life, that can get you arrested. That can get you sent to prison.
There's one way to love you, but 1,000 ways to kill you, and I'm not going to rest until your body is a mess, soaked in blood and dying from all the little cuts. It's distasteful. The more people told me that I couldn't do it, the more that I wanted to do it, to push the buttons.
Today on the show, he called it artistic expression. The government called it a threat. When is speech a red flag? I'm Matthew Schwartz.
I'm Mike Volo.
And this is Unprecedented. In 2001, Anthony Alonis met Tara on the internet. They were both teenagers living in eastern Pennsylvania.
The two were married in the fall of 2002 by a magistrate judge. They did not have a reception.
We did the justice of the peace thing. She was 16. I was 19, so I had to get her parents' permission.
We really wanted to hear this story from Tara's perspective, too. We left voicemails and text messages, but we never heard back. What you're hearing now, of course, is Anthony's version.
We got married on Eminem's 30th birthday, October 17, 2002. She testified at court that I never listened to rap music, and that's a lie. One of my punishments growing up is to have my albums taken away. Big Pun, Rough Riders, obviously you have Eminem. My name is, you know, his first major release. I bought his album. I listened to him ever since. It's an artist that I related to. It's an artist that my ex-wife in the past has related to.
Anthony and Tara were married for about 7 years before things started falling apart. Anthony says he was spending too much time at work, too much time partying. And when they argued, he was cruel.
Do you feel like you were verbally abusive to her?
I think so, yes. When things don't go my way, I tend to not handle that very well. If we're having an argument, I tend to go for the jugular. I'll use anything that I know that you feel weak about, I'll use that against you. So I can understand why she left.
You keep alluding to your job. What were you doing at the time? Tell me where you were working.
I worked seasonally for Dorney Park. I worked up until October of 2010, and I was fired.
Halloween haunt at Dorney Park.
A coworker at the park had posed with Alonis during a Halloween event. He was dressed in costume, and he held a toy knife to her throat. It was a joke, but he then had a falling out with the coworker and posted the photo online with the caption, "I wish." The park ended his employment.
I wasn't really sleeping. I hadn't slept for 3 days. I was definitely doing drugs. I was definitely drinking. Definitely wasn't sleeping. That doesn't mean that I didn't have a understanding of what I was doing.
But then at some point you took on this alter ego that you called
Tone Dougie.
Tone Dougie. this was a sort of rap alter ego, and you started writing rap lyrics.
Tone Dougie never actually recorded anything. He never laid down tracks. He mostly just posted lyrics online on his Facebook page. According to Anthony Alonis, Tone Dougie was therapeutic.
I think it's very important to have a way for us to channel our creative energy, and that may not look the same to everyone.
Do you remember and can you recite one of those raps?
There's one way to love you, but 1,000 ways to kill you, and I'm not going to rest.
And I'm not going to rest until your body is a mess.
Nina Totenberg covered this story for NPR.
Soaked in blood and dying from all the little cuts. Hurry up and die.
It's distasteful. And I'm not going to go into it because I'm not happy with the content.
And then his wife, Tara, went to court and she got a protective order, barring him from coming anywhere near her or their children. And just 3 days after the court hearing, he posted another Facebook message. Did you know that it's illegal for me to say I want to kill my wife?
Alonis was actually riffing on a bit from a sketch comedy group called The Whitest Kids You Know.
Did you know that it's illegal to say I want to kill the president of the United States of America? It's illegal. It's a federal offense. It's one of the only sentences that you're not allowed to say. Now, it was okay for me to say it right then.
Alonis changed the words so that instead of the president, he was talking about his wife.
A week later, he posted this about his wife. Fold up your protective order and put it in your pocket. Is it thick enough to stop a bullet? And the next day, he said he was ready to, quote, make a name for himself with the most heinous elementary school shooting ever imagined.
They took my kids away because of stuff I put on Facebook. Like, I feel I have a right to say this. I feel that even though you disagree with me, you don't, there is no heckler veto. You can't tell me not to say that. The more people told me that I couldn't do it, the more that I wanted to do it, to push the buttons.
That post got the attention of FBI agent Denise Stevens, who visited Alonis at home afterwards with her partner. And then he posted this message. Little agent lady stood so close, took all the strength I had not to turn the ghost.
Pull my knife, flick my wrist, and slit her throat. Leave her bleeding from her jugular in the arms of her partner. That would be little agent lady.
Little agent lady being one of the FBI agents that knocked on your door.
Well, I mean, I don't want to say yes. I mean, it could have been any situation involving someone from law, well, agent, FBI, DEA, whatever. It was written out of the meeting, but that doesn't mean that it needs to be read as that specific agent. It doesn't need to be read like that.
But it was read like that, and it was one threat too many. Alonis was arrested and charged with violating Section 875C of the United States Criminal Code, which prohibits making any communication containing a threat to injure another person.
The government didn't care that Alonis made some of these threats under his rap alter ego, Tone Dougie. The government also didn't care that Alonis linked to the Wikipedia page on freedom of speech. They did care that he violated the law.
So he was prosecuted for these threats and convicted by a jury. The judge instructed the jury that to convict, it must find that the Facebook posts constituted true threats, meaning that in context, a reasonable person would foresee that the statements would be interpreted as a serious expression of an intent to inflict bodily harm. And so he was convicted and sentenced to 3.5 years. And he said, look, I was just venting. There are disclaimers all over the page saying I'm just venting. Therefore, it's not a violation of the law. It's an expression of his free speech.
Again, I tried to contact Anthony Alonis's ex-wife, Tara. We really wanted to know how all of this had affected her and her children, how it may have changed them. No response. We confided to Nina that we were disappointed.
But you see, she just wants to be left alone. She's afraid of him. And I am sure she doesn't want to do anything that will provoke him. And he has lots of rationalizations, and these are very post hoc rationalizations. We'll never know whether he was using the First Amendment as a cover, and what he really was trying to do was scare the bejesus out of her, whether he was doing both, both expressing himself and trying to scare the bejesus out of her. But whatever he says now is not a valid explanation, in my view.
There was a lot to indicate that he just viewed himself as a First Amendment sort of activist.
This is John Elwood. He was Anthony Alonis's attorney through much of the case.
You know, in the sort of days after he had lost his job and his wife, I think that he found some appeal in giving his life meaning by being sort of a First Amendment advocate. That's my armchair psychology.
I believe that there exists a line between protected and unprotected speech, and that we need citizens to get to that line to prevent the government from moving it. So it was important for me to do that, because they'll continue to move it until there's no room for any discourse. I remember watching The People versus Larry Flint, and I thought that I could do that. So I had researched true threats. I knew there was a potential for a Supreme Court case, and I latched on to it.
Coming up, Anthony Alonis spent 3.5 years in prison for his Facebook posts. Did he get what he deserved?
I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're listening to the latest episode of the podcast Unprecedented about the case of Anthony Alonis. He spent more than 3 years in prison for making threatening posts on Facebook. He claimed the posts were just rap lyrics protected by the First Amendment, and eventually the Supreme Court took up his case. Hosts Matthew Schwartz and Mike Volo interviewed Mr. Alonis for the podcast. Again, this episode discusses threats of domestic violence, which you may find disturbing. If you need to listen later, you'll find it online at the1a.org.
Did you intend to threaten your wife?
No.
Did you know that by posting those lyrics, she would feel threatened?
I believed in the possibility that she could take that as a threat. Then the question becomes, well, how much fear is necessary to remove speech from the protection of the First Amendment? Anybody can say, I'm afraid of the consequences of this speech. Anybody can say that. But how much fear is necessary to remove speech from the protection of the First Amendment?
How would you answer that question yourself?
There's gotta be a lot of fear. I wasn't following her. I wasn't going to her place of employment. She had no contact with me. The only thing she knew of me is what her friends were telling her. She wasn't my friend on Facebook.
Did you make it public?
It was public, yes.
So you knew that she could see it?
I knew that. So yes, yes, there's the possibility that she would have seen it. And as it turns out, she did.
It's important to get inside Anthony Alonis's head, because what he was thinking when he wrote those Facebook posts speaks directly to his motivation.
Can I ask you this? Did you hope she would see it?
I had hoped that she would see the pain that I was going through. To be honest with you, I probably didn't channel that in the best way. But I mean, there was a little hope that she would see it, yeah.
So you hoped she might see it. Did you hope that she would feel threatened?
No.
Matt, I'm going to interrupt here because I feel like we need to mention that Tara had taken out a restraining order against Anthony. They call it a protection from abuse order, a PFA. And he later wrote on Facebook, "Fold up your PFA and put it in your pocket. Is it thick enough to stop a bullet?" Which makes one wonder, how could he write this stuff hoping she would see it and not expect her to feel threatened?
I mean, so without speaking of the positives and the negatives of a PFA, it is just a document. It is not going to protect you from someone that wishes to do you harm.
So when you wrote something like a PFA isn't going to stop a bullet, you must have known that that was going to make her feel threatened if she saw it.
I think I wanted her to see that I could do this.
Do what?
Write what I wanted to write, and that she wasn't going to stop me, and that the court wasn't going to stop me, and I was going to continue to do it. That I drew the line in the sand, and I wasn't going to back down.
You'll hear argument next this morning in case 13983, Ilonis versus United States. Mr. Elwood?
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The First Amendment permits restrictions.
So you were arguing that this is artistic expression?
Yes, it was worth protecting. Exactly, because that's, you know, I definitely got questions and argument about why should we try to protect the speech? It's a very low-value speech.
Ilonis' attorney, John Elwood.
You know, it's not really communicating any great elevated idea. And, you know, I tried to talk about how these things are, you know, worth expressing artistically because, you know, it communicates a lot of very intense emotions. They may not be pretty emotions, but they are cathartic sometimes to people who do them. I mean, like the best example is Eminem, and anybody who's ever gone through a bad divorce might enjoy listening to Eminem.
Where's mama? She's taking a little nap in the trunk. Oh, that smell. Daddy must have run over a skunk.
Now, he's written some songs that are just absolutely blistering about, you know, essentially drowning his ex-wife, throwing her in the water. And one of the things I found kind of most professionally satisfying is when you can get, as happened in the argument, you can get Chief Justice John Roberts quoting Eminem to your opposing counsel and saying, well, couldn't Eminem be prosecuted for this?
You know, Adam, make a nice bed for mommy at the bottom of the lake, tie a rope around her rock. This is during the context of a domestic dispute between, you know, a husband and wife.
This is Chief Justice John Roberts questioning the attorney for the government, Michael Dreeben.
There goes mama splashing in the water, no more fighting with dad, you know, all that stuff.
There goes mama splashing in the water, no more fighting with dad, no more restraining order, no more stepdad, no more new brother, blow a kiss, bye-bye, tell mama you love her, and we'll go play in the sand, build a castle.
Could that be prosecuted?
No, because if you look at the context of these statements...
Because Eminem said it instead of somebody else?
Because Eminem said it at a concert where people are going to be entertained. This is a critical part of the context. It wasn't as if he stated it to her in private or on a Facebook page, and that is a...
So how do you start out if you want to be a rap artist? Your first communication, you can't say, I'm an artist, right?
I think that you have perfect freedom to engage in rap artistry. What you don't have perfect freedom to do is to make statements that are like the ones in this case. He knows that his wife is reading these posts. He knows that his posts, despite the fact that they're in the guise of rap music, have instilled fear in her. And he goes out and he ramps up and escalates the threatening character of the statements.
So, John, do you think that if Eminem had written some of those lyrics, and instead of recording it, if Facebook had been around back then, just posted it, do you think he might have faced the same sort of trouble?
I think he could definitely have been prosecuted. And that's kind of the argument that I made. It's something that Chief Justice John Roberts seems sympathetic to. The idea that is, you know, that Marshall Mathers, before he had broken through, could have been prosecuted just like Tone Dougie was.
Yeah, and how do you become Eminem
right.
if you're not
you
first
exactly
Marshall
right.
Mathers writing mm-hmm. those lyrics?
Right, exactly. Although, you know, I try to be scrupulously fair and balanced is, you know, it helps to record it first. So, before you go posting it on Facebook.
Your dad, I love you. I love you, baby.
This is one of the communications in this case for which your client was convicted.
This is Justice Samuel Alito questioning Ilonis' attorney, John Elwood.
That's it. I've had about enough. I'm checking out and making a name for myself. Enough elementary schools in a 10-mile radius to initiate the most heinous school shooting ever imagined. And hell hath no fury like a crazy man in a kindergarten class. The only question is, which one? Now, suppose that this was altered a little bit. So at the bottom, he puts... just kidding, laughing out loud. And at the top, he puts Tone Dougie, aspiring rap artist. Okay, what's a jury to do with that under your theory? That you have to get into the mind of this obsessed, somewhat disturbed individual to figure out whether he really knew that this would cause a panic on the part of the school officials and parents who found out about this?
Yes. Yes, exactly. And it's the same thing that juries
do all
the
time. That's what Congress intended.
So that free verse poem about a school shooting, I'm not even going to call it a rap because it really wasn't, that in the context of a Facebook post, stripped of any obvious artistic intent, it reads like a threat. And it should be taken seriously. I would want law enforcement all over Alonis if he lived near my son's elementary school.
Well, yeah, reading violent rap lyrics aloud in a courtroom without a beat would make anyone sound disturbed. But I want to try something. I asked Ben, our sound engineer, to take those lyrics as read by Justice Alito and present them as they might sound at an actual concert.
That's it. I've had about enough. I'm checking out and making a name for myself. Enough elementary schools in a 10-mile radius to initiate the most heinous school shooting ever imagined. And hell hath no fury like a crazy man in a kindergarten class. The only question is, which one? Just kidding. Tone Dougie. Just kidding. Tone Dougie. Just kidding.
Well, what do you think?
I mean, it's better, I guess. It sounds closer to art than it did before. But, you know, look, I've listened to enough rap to qualify as discerning. And with or without a beat, it's just not good. In fact, it's bad. And I've never been a big Eminem fan, but he was clearly a skilled lyricist. If you want to be Eminem, then make a demo. Don't post it on your Facebook, especially when you're emotionally distraught after losing custody of your kids.
How do you feel knowing that you got arrested for your poetry, your rap lyrics, while famous rappers like Eminem write the same sorts of things and make millions of dollars?
I don't want to play the victim. It was excruciating. I remember shortly into my imprisonment, I remember Foster the People, the Pumped Up Kicks. That was on the radio every hour at least.
How does that one go?
Wait, was it All the Other Kids with the Pumped Up Kicks? Better run faster than my bullet. Is that how it goes? I mean, the argument was always that, well, you're not them. So I like Robert's line of thinking is, well, how do you become them? And I don't think that any American should be denied the opportunity to follow their dreams, whatever that may be.
Did you want to be a rapper?
I think I wanted a Supreme Court case more than I wanted to be a rapper, to be honest with you.
And as we mentioned, along with his violent rap lyrics, Anthony Alonis was also posting disclaimer after disclaimer. Here's his attorney, John Elwood, talking to Justice Alito, who seemed less sympathetic than Justice Roberts to the Eminem argument.
Context. If you could look at page 344, this is the standard disclaimer which appeared on his webpage, which says all content posted to this is strictly for entertainment purposes only.
Well, this sounds like a roadmap for threatening a spouse and getting away with it. So you put it in rhyme, and you put some stuff about the Internet on it, and you say, I'm an aspiring rap artist, and so then you're free from prosecution.
And the jury, the prosecution would be perfectly free to point out all the things that they find on the phone.
Yeah, and he said, this is venting, don't take this seriously. And he said, in context, therefore, it's not a violation of the law. It's an expression of his free speech.
And one could say, and it sounds somewhat shocking to put it so starkly, but one could say that he went to jail for 3.5 years for speech. He didn't do any of the things he said he wanted to do or that this character, Tone Dougie, that he wrote as, wanted to do.
Well, he told us he didn't intend to do it.
I have to tell you that I cover the Supreme Court and I see a lot of cases involving somebody who commits a horrific crime against his wife and or children. And there are lots of warning signs. And these are the warning signs. Language like this is the warning sign. You see it as a red flag over and over and over again. Hopefully that he doesn't kill anybody. But how do you balance the right to free speech in this very typical situation involving domestic, at least terror, if not violence, and try to make sure that there isn't a murder?
So you're saying if these aren't warning signs, then, then what are, really? Yeah.
If these aren't warning signs, what is a warning sign?
When the Supreme Court took this case, they were thinking about the First Amendment, about whether the First Amendment protects speech that may seem threatening, about whether the First Amendment protects Anthony Alonis. Here's where the case takes a bit of a detour. Justice Stephen Breyer.
Forget the First Amendment issue here. Take it to the side. Forget it. It has to do with the state of mind. So you have to know that you are transmitting a true threat. And if you don't know that, you're home free.
We said at the beginning that it's important to get into the mind of Anthony Alonis.
Right, because we need to know if Anthony wanted Tara to be afraid, because that would make his words a true threat and therefore a crime.
But the jury wasn't told to figure out what was going on in Anthony Alonis's mind. The jury was asked, would a reasonable person believe that those Facebook posts would be perceived as a threat?
So let's say I'm the theoretical reasonable person. The jury is wondering if I, looking at those Facebook posts, would think that Tara would take them as a threat.
Yeah, that's what the jury was instructed to ponder. But that's not what juries are supposed to ponder in a criminal case. They're not supposed to get into the mind of a reasonable person. They're supposed to get into the mind of the person charged with the crime.
So did Anthony Alonis himself intend his statements to be interpreted as a threat?
Exactly. So the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Anthony Alonis because Alonis was convicted for what a reasonable person might have thought and not for what he himself thought. Here is Chief Justice John Roberts delivering the opinion.
There is a general principle in our system of federal criminal law that serious criminal punishment should only be imposed for conscious wrongdoing. Alonis says the jury should have been required to find that he intended to threaten someone before convicting him. We agree.
How exactly does the First Amendment come into play? The court didn't answer that. They simply said that what Anthony Alonis was thinking matters. And because the jury didn't consider that, his conviction cannot stand.
Alonis wanted a Supreme Court case. He got what he wanted, but he spent 3.5 years in prison, and the question still lingers. Does the First Amendment protect speech that is possibly artistic, maybe cathartic, and seemingly threatening?
Just because you can say it doesn't mean you should say it. Well, someone has to say the things that you shouldn't say before those things become the things that you can't say. But it costs a lot.
We've been listening to the final episode of WAMU's podcast Unprecedented about the Supreme Court case of Alonis versus United States. Coming up, we'll talk about the impact of that case both on rap music and how it intersects with the law and how we deal with threats online. Stay close. We have just heard the story of Anthony Ilonis. He spent more than 3 years in prison for posting threats on Facebook before the Supreme Court overturned his conviction. That case has had some huge and perhaps unexpected ramifications for free speech law. Joining us now in studio to discuss it is Marianne Franks, a professor at the University of Miami School of Law. She's also the author of The Cult of the Constitution, Our Deadly Devotion to Guns and Free Speech. Professor Franks, it's always good to have a fellow hurricane in the studio. Welcome to 1A.
Thank you so much.
Joining us from NPR in New York is Eric Nielsen, an associate professor of liberal arts at the University of Richmond. He is the co-author of Rap on Trial, Race, Lyrics, and Guilt in America. Professor Nielsen, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And now that you've heard the story of Anthony Ilonis, we would love your questions and reactions to it. Remember, you can hear it again on the podcast Unprecedented from our colleagues at WAMU. For now, we welcome your questions and thoughts by email 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Professor Franks, could you put this case in a little context? Remind us what was going on in the country, in the zeitgeist, when the Supreme Court decided to take this case up.
Well, it gets really complicated, as the podcast had indicated, because so many people assumed that this case was going to be the real case that the Supreme Court tackles to tell us something useful about how the First Amendment operates in the internet age and whether or not someone's self-identification as an artist is going to affect the analysis of whether they're allowed to say certain things. And so we had all of this tension being built up around whether this was going to be a case about rap or whether this was going to be a case about domestic violence or whether this is going to be a case about Facebook and the First Amendment. And then the court essentially says, you know, we're not going to talk about any of that. We're essentially just going to take this as what is called a statutory construction issue, which is how to interpret a law that seems a little bit ambiguous. And on those very narrow grounds, we're essentially going to say nothing about the First Amendment at all. And we're simply going to say, in essence, that when it comes to making a threat, when it comes to violating a federal statute that has serious consequences, we're going to require that there be some kind of subjective awareness on the part of the person who's being charged. And that was essentially all they told us.
Professor Nielsen, you filed a friend of the court brief, an amicus brief, on behalf of Anthony Ilonis in this case. How did you get involved in the case, and what did you argue in that brief?
Well, I got involved in the case because my research over the last several years has focused on the use of rap lyrics as evidence in criminal cases. And my interest is in preventing those lyrics from being misrepresented in a courtroom. And so I got involved in this case because it did, at least at some level, involve rap lyrics. And one of the things that I've noticed in a lot of my work, and I testify in these cases as well, is that there is just a lack of information about the genre, and lots of the characterizations of it that you see in a legal context are just incorrect. And so my goal, both when I work on these cases, but also with that amicus brief, was to provide some education into the conventions of the genre and to explain that what might seem like a threat to somebody unfamiliar with rap music would, to someone familiar with it, seem like standard fare, that these are what you would expect, the kinds of lyrics you would expect from the music.
Can you give me a little bit more detail on what you're referring to? I mean, rap, there are many different kinds of rap music. I came up in the 80s when hip-hop was just kind of hitting the scene, like a few years after Rapper's Delight, and there's a lot of rap music that is legendary and amazing and doesn't threaten or demean or express chauvinism to anybody.
That's true. And those are not the lyrics that are showing up in legal contexts. What you saw sort of beginning in the late 1980s is you saw that rap music started to move. Really early rap music tended to be, like you said, it was fairly clean, was often more party-based music. But as you got to the late 80s and early 1990s, it became, on the one hand, more confrontational politically. But on the other hand, it started to embrace these themes that actually go back more than a century, but themes that sort of foregrounded the pimps, the hustlers, and that's where you started to see what you would call gangster rap. And you saw that when that style of rap emerged, it became incredibly popular and incredibly influential. And so what you see even today is that many amateur artists, artists who would like to become the next Eminem, the next Jay-Z, this is the genre, the subgenre of rap music that they're often imitating and practicing first, because they believe that that's the type of music that they need to master in order to eventually become a more well-known artist.
Professor Franks, how big do you see the problem of online threats and abuse today? Is it growing? Is it shrinking? Have we begun to get our arms around it? Where are we right now?
We're in a really bad place. So when we look at the statistics about how many Americans, for instance, have experienced online harassment, we're looking at 41% of Americans experiencing some sort of online abuse and something like 1 in 10 that experience threats. And when we factor into that how much of this involves domestic violence victims, which is really what this case is about, certainly more than it is about anything to do with rap music. This is really about a domestic abuser who was trying to use the First Amendment and trying to appropriate an entire genre of music in order to defend what he wanted to do, which was to terrify his wife and to punish her for leaving him. So when we consider how common domestic violence is, 1 in 3 women being affected by it, we really should keep that in mind when we're making any kind of assessments of freedom of speech or what we think actually the court is going to say or do when it comes to the boundaries of the First Amendment.
Professor Nielsen, you've been involved in other cases, as you mentioned, where rap lyrics have been used in trials, including with Michael Render, who's a rapper known as Killer Mike, one of the better-known rappers, I think, of the rap scene. He featured on the song The Whole World by Outkast from one of their great hits. Here is a clip of him talking about the case of a man named Jamal Knox. He was speaking at a Washington Post event this past June.
At what point do my feelings... are they not equal to the feelings of others or the feelings of the majority? And at what point do I get prosecuted just for feeling a way and then having the courage to say that I feel this way? I could say, and a bunch of us have said, even to the people we love, I just want to kill you. Well, if we let freedom of speech go out the door with it hurts my feelings, I believe that we put ourselves in an environment where feeling something and saying it vocally, publicly, could potentially get any one of us put in prison. And what's really scary to me is that laws like this usually affect people who look like me first and worst.
That was Michael Render, better known as Killer Mike, speaking at a Washington Post event this past June. Professor Nielsen, he is clearly talking about a double standard here. What makes Anthony Ilonis' case different from other cases of rappers who may have been jailed because of their lyrics?
Right. I mean, the case that Michael Render, Killer Mike, was referring to, the Jamal Knox case, is a more typical case. I mean, this was an aspiring rapper who had recorded multiple songs. More than that, he was using his song to criticize and call attention to police brutality in his Pittsburgh community. That makes him a far more sympathetic figure than Mr. Ilonis, who it was not clear that he was really an aspiring rap artist. He was not recording his music. He was, in his Facebook posts, yes, he was certainly channeling artists like Eminem, but he was also channeling other forms of popular culture. So it's not as if this was purely a rap lyrics case. And what's more, he was not using his music to either call attention to any sort of political or social cause or issue. And he clearly wasn't using the music to sort of build a career or a vocation. And that's far more typical, is that these young men, the young men that I'm referring to, are using their music often to call attention to injustice. And I should say that in lots of the cases where they are prosecuted for true threats, it's because they had the audacity to criticize authority figures, often police. And in the case of Ilonis, however, it's absolutely correct that it was complicated by the fact that he was using his lyrics, for ill intent.
Well, Professor Franks, what about that? I mean, does it make a difference from a legal perspective who you are threatening? I mean, you know, I immediately thought about Cop Killer by Ice-T, which is a very violent song where it's basically about someone who's coming after police officers. You know, I got my brain on hype. Tonight will be your night. I got this long ass knife and your neck looks just right. My adrenaline's pumping. I got my stereo bumping. I'm about to kill me something. A pig stopped me for nothing. Cop Killer, better you than me. Cop Killer, F police brutality. Cop Killer, I know your mom is grieving. Cop Killer, but tonight we get even. Very controversial track, highly controversial lyrics, rapped from an honest place about black men who are tired of police officers killing us for nothing. Where is the line?
I don't think we know what the line is, but I think that we can make some distinctions based on exactly what you've just quoted there, which is we're talking about someone articulating political anger. We're talking about someone who's highlighting a social ill. That is very different from someone saying, I'm in a very personal context where I am angry at someone for leaving me. I'm devastated that they left me. And I think an appropriate response to being left is to threaten violence.
And it would have made a difference, I think, if we had known whether Ice-T had a particular police officer in mind, as opposed to talking about police brutality in general?
As, you know, this is one of the things the Supreme Court has told us, not in Alanis, again, because the court did this strange thing in the case where they don't talk about the First Amendment, but more generally, when the court does try to figure out what a true threat is, it looks at the context of these kinds of words. So it's thinking about, well, is there a specific victim, as you're indicating? And also, are we talking about a realistic threat as opposed to hyperbole or some kind of joke, right? So the court is very sensitive to the nuances and the context in which we're making that kind of proclamation. So in a context where we're not naming someone and saying specifically it's that person, and when we're not actually trying to say I'm about to kill this person maybe tomorrow, the court's much more likely to say that's not a true threat and probably will say it's protected by the First Amendment.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. With regards to that idea of a true threat, Professor Nielsen, one of our listeners, Linda, wrote on our Facebook page, if it is a threat, it is a threat, no matter if you sing it, say it, write it. I don't think under the law Linda is correct, because what if I act it? What if I recite it from a book? It's still a threat technically, but I'm not threatening someone, which I think is why the ruling is so baffling. I mean, this was an 8-1 ruling, but they punted on the First Amendment question. It's like they just decided not to solve the problem.
Well, it's a tough problem to solve.
But that's their job, isn't it? To solve these kind of tough problems?
Well, I do agree that it would have been nice if they had addressed the First Amendment in their decision. It would have provided clarity instead of the confusion that that we still see. But I mean, to say that a threat is a threat is a threat is obviously an oversimplification. And I, not even legally, I would say artistically, that doesn't really stand up to scrutiny. I mean, for example, if I were to show you two battle rappers, and battle rapping is when two rappers, often in improvised fashion, stand face to face and battle each other in verse. The rhetoric becomes incredibly heated. It's graphically violent, and you know, to win is to body bag somebody, right? So that suggests murder. But everybody there understands that violence is the last thing that's going to happen. And in fact, if you ever had to resort to violence in a competition like that, you would lose,
right?
Because you couldn't summon the rhetorical skills to respond. And so that's not a threat at all, even though it uses threatening language. You need to understand those types of things in order to put rap in its proper context. And if you do that, a threat is a threat starts to fall apart.
Professor Franks, in the time we have left, where does this leave us in terms of understanding violent rhetoric? You know, the Supreme Court has ruled in the past in cases like, you know, Brandenburg v. Ohio about threats that are intended to and likely to cause imminent violence. It's why, you know, Klan rallies are protected speech as long as they don't call someone by name and name a time and a place where you want to attack this person. Where does this leave us in terms of our understanding of where, and particularly what happened in Charlottesville, which I think made a lot of Americans wonder where the line is. Where does this leave us in terms of our understanding of where the line is?
It leaves us very much in a free speech dystopia. In other words, where it leaves us is where we have been for most of our history, which is that the most powerful members of society, or those who articulate ideas that are most consonant with the way power works, are the ones who get the most protection. So domestic violence abusers, white supremacists, it's not actually that surprising that they're the ones who get to garner all of this credibility under the First Amendment. Whereas, as was so poignantly pointed out in the podcast, the victims of this kind of speech, or the targets of this speech, the people who are being threatened in Charlottesville, Tara, in the case of Alonis, their speech is lost. So what we heard in the podcast was repeated attempts to contact Tara, and she doesn't want to talk to us. She doesn't get to speak. She doesn't get to express herself. She doesn't get to have the kind of freedom of expression that people like Alonis will claim for themselves.
Because she feels chilled in speaking.
Exactly, because she has to worry that her speech might actually trigger a violent response. And that's what happens in Charlottesville, too. And so we worry, or we should be worried, about the fact that the First Amendment is so often being wielded as a tool of the powerful against the relatively less powerful.
And Professor Nielsen, how do you see it before we go?
the exact same way, actually, that it is what Michael Render said in the quote in the clip that you played, that people, marginalized groups and communities, feel the brunt of this type of regulation, and we see this with rap music as well. If rappers want to engage in the type of rhetoric that we see common throughout popular culture, they are the first to face punishment. And that is because the primary producers of rap music are young men of color. And so it is absolutely true that people with the least amount of power are the ones who are most likely to be targeted under speech restrictions as well.
Eric Nielsen, an associate professor at the University of Richmond and co-author of Rap on Trial, Race, Lyrics, and Guilt in America. Professor Nielsen, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
And University of Miami professor of law, Marianne Franks. She's the author of The Cult of the Constitution, Our Deadly Devotion to Guns and Free Speech. Professor Franks, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And hey, thanks to our friends at Unprecedented, our colleagues here at WAMU. You can check out their podcast wherever you get your podcast, as well as the 1A podcast. All the links to listen to our show are online at npr.org/1A. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. This is 1A.